All right. Hello, everyone. And thank you for bearing with me there while we did a quick sound check to make sure that everyone was good to go. I'm going to ask our participants to put a few messages in the chat box right now to make sure you can hear me. And I am Molly Uline Olmsted, Creative Learning Engineer and presenter. Okay, great. And the Creative Learning Factory is a professional development arm of the Ohio Historical Society, and we provide engaging workshops, webinars, and customized hands-on, minds-on experiences for teachers, museum professionals, and other professionals working in the nonprofit sector. This webinar is for our Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma History Project, and with us today we have Dr. Steve Warren, who is an associate professor newly of University of Iowa starting August 2014, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about the work that he's doing for the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma History Project, and also about the wonderful research that he's done for his two books, The Shawnees and Their Neighbors, and The Worlds the Shawnees Made, which is his newest book, which just came out this past winter. And I want to thank you guys for joining us. In the interest of time, since we only have about a half hour, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Steve right now. I'm going to quickly stop sharing the PowerPoint that you see and bring up Steve's PowerPoint, and then we will be good to go. It'll just take just a second there. All right. Steve, are you ready?
I am. Can you hear me? Can everybody hear me? Hello? Okay, great. First, thank you, Molly, for introducing me, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm going to move pretty quickly. And in the case of just self-interest, I wanted to share this promotion code with you. We'll go back to it at the end, but if you want to purchase the book, there it is at 40% off. So without further ado, what I want to do is to try to connect all of my work in a half an hour and do that to the grant. I'm not sure that I'll be successful. Hopefully there'll be time for questions. And if you all have any questions at all, please don't hesitate to research or to I'm sorry, to contact me via email. So what I want to do is to take you through a couple of themes that I think are important in American Indian history and that are relevant to our interests. The first is that in Native American history, there's a very strong connection, at least in the scholarly literature, between homeland, place, and identity. So what I mean by that is that if you read most of the scholarship in my field, they describe Native peoples as being uniquely wedded to very specific places. And indeed, for most of the people from what is the Middle Ohio Valley in the pre-contact period, that was the case. So we're going to be talking about the Fort Ancient peoples today. And you can see this map indicates their zone of habitation. In this Fort Ancient region, most of the people who lived there were living in small but sophisticated towns. However, it's a huge geographic area, and so we shouldn't confuse this large region with one tribal group, or one modern, federally recognized Native nation. It was a linguistically and culturally diverse place. Having said that, one of the remarkable things about the Fort Ancient region is that the people who lived there inhabited this region for more than 20 generations with very little turnover. So there isn't a lot of evidence of cataclysmic change regarding culture and identity. It's a pretty stable place. And so I just want you to keep that theme in mind as we move through this presentation. The second theme that I want to talk about is the Native Americans and the idea of factionalism. You know, when I was in graduate school, my teachers and my colleagues used to talk about the idea, oh, if only the the poor Native Americans had gotten together to fight colonizers, everything would have been great. And behind that idea is a kind of a blame the victim mentality. There's an insinuation that it's somehow Native people's fault that they didn't, unite and form a stronger opposition to colonization. And most of it stems from a fallacy regarding the pre-contact period. And that is, there's an idea or an understanding that is still in existence among scholars in some corners of the academic world that Native people prior to contact were members of nation states. And so what that means is that scholars have a tendency to confuse political and cultural identity, or at least to conflate political and cultural identity to make them the same. And in my work, one of the things that I've argued is that really they should be thought of as different. One can be culturally Shawnee, but not politically a member of a nation. It's much more common for people in today's Shawnee communities and in pre-contact Fort Ancient communities to have thought of themselves as members of villages. Nevertheless, some historians will use examples such as this barred copper pendant to make an argument that Fort Ancient people were members of a nation. They'll see it as a symbol of a kind of a presidency, for lack of a better phrase, that there must have been a powerful leader. But if this had been the case, then we wouldn't see barred pendants fairly widely distributed across Fort Ancient villages. So these two ideas are really important for me for what I want to communicate today. So this is the best representation of what a Fort Ancient village from the Middle Ohio Valley would have looked like on the eve of contact. And one of the things that I'd like to emphasize is that while this 700-year occupation was stable, the village size and location did change quite a lot over time. And so on the eve of contact, Fort Ancient farmers consolidated into larger villages, typically of between 500 and 1,000 people, in and around the Ohio River Valley. And what archaeologists have found is that that consolidation was caused primarily by climate change. It became colder on the eve of contact, and as a result, Native people moved into areas that were both rich in terms of agricultural production and in terms of animal life. And so they had to be very, very careful about where they were in order to make it through the long, tough winter. And what fascinates me is the transformation that occurred in this very, very short period of time. Between 1630 and 1680, this 700-year period of continuous occupation fell apart in about 50 years, or even smaller than two generations. And so these people who had been known for corn agriculture, small egalitarian villages, and so on, they were one of the most place-bound populations really in the world, became one of the most transient and migratory. And in my book, what I try to do is to build a bridge between the Fort Ancient world and the modern or colonial world by following migrants from the Fort Ancient region, from the Middle Ohio River Valley, across their diaspora, which spanned really the entirety of the eastern United States. And I love this period of time. It's an awful time because it's so horribly destructive, but it's also one of the most creative periods in human history because Fort Ancient farmers become transient and adaptive, and they really transform their identities to suit a variety of new and colonial worlds. And so now what I'd like to do is to take you through this transformation. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to emphasize four sites for modern Shawnee people. These are the first places where modern Shawnee people were found, or where they basically came into communication with Europeans. These places are the confluence of the Ohio and Scioto Rivers, the Upper Illinois River Valley, the Middle Savannah River, and the Lower Susquehanna River. And in these places, really in the 1670s, between 1674 and 1680, Shawnee people are first recorded as having direct contact with Europeans. What's surprising about this is that the Fort Ancient farmers had known Europeans since 1539 through what archaeologists call down-the-line trading. What I mean by that is they had traded for European goods without even laying eyes on a European for at least 130 years prior to their first contact with Europeans themselves. And so what we see happening between 1630 and 1680 is Shawnee people moving to places where they could trade directly with Europeans. And so the question becomes, well, what caused that? And there are three causes of it. There's no single smoking gun. The first cause is just a desire for direct trade. For a variety of reasons, it became very, very difficult for the Shawnees to access trade goods between 1630 and 1680, and so they have to move to get them. The second, and I think important cause, is the Native American slave trade. And so there are people who are being funded by European colonizers to capture other native people. And they're moving up through the New and Kiwanis River Valley from Virginia primarily, and attacking the Middle Ohio River Valley peoples. There are also Iroquois war parties that are moving in, and through their Morning War complex, devastating the area. And finally, there is disease. And it's very, very hard to find disease on or in the Middle Ohio River Valley. It's tough to trace, but most archaeologists argue convincingly that the trade brought with it disease down the rivers to the Middle Ohio River Valley. And so these three causes, warfare, trade, and disease, forced one of the most place-bound populations in the world to move. And so we find evidence of Fort Ancient ceramics at these four sites. However, the ceramic material has changed somewhat. And so there's a notion that the styles drifted with the people, so that as people moved, they adjusted their ceramic forms as they learned new ways from new peoples. One of the surprising things about my research is that you find migrants such as the Shawnees living at some of the most violent locations in colonial America. And so all of those four locations were exceedingly difficult, tough places to live. For example, the Middle Savannah River, which is basically where Augusta, Georgia is today, the site of the Masters Golf Tournament. That location was an important site of the Indian slave trade. And so scholars estimate that about 50,000 native people were enslaved between 1670 and 1715. And for every one person who became a slave, at least another four people died. And so you can imagine just how devastating the Indian slave trade was, not only to the people who became slaves, but to their loved ones who most likely perished in wars associated with it. And so we have farmers from the Middle Ohio River Valley who are becoming traders, mercenaries, and people deeply engaged with rituals associated with war. So this is a very surprising ethnogenesis. One of the more important spots along the colonial borderlands that Shawnees were moved to was the lower Susquehanna River. And so here in this map, you can see a couple of locations where Shawnees resided. I just want to point out something about this map that is interesting, to me at least, and that is that you can see the divisional affiliation of Shawnee migrants on the map. And so if we look at, for example, the site of Pequahan, which is here, that is another name, of course, for the Pekuitha division of the Shawnee people. There were five Shawnee divisions. Above that is Conestoga, which is the largest tribal town of the Susquehannock. And above it is the Caughnawaga, which is a Kanoi or Eastern Algonquian town. And finally, here we have a Delaware town. And so you can see a lot of interesting things in the choices people made when they relocated to colonial hotspots. They tended to migrate as members of tribes, but more specifically, as the member of clans or divisions within that. And so some scholars would argue that Native people coalesce, that the lines between Shawnee, Susquehannock, and Kanoi and Delaware become hard to discern. But as this map indicates, Delaware, Kanoi, Susquehannock, and Shawnee are still distinct. People still live in their own unique tribal villages. They refuse to coalesce and become some kind of amalgam of diasporic refugees, which is what many scholars would have us believe, but it's simply not borne out by the evidence. Another thing that I'll point out about this map and about the four locations that I mentioned is that they're almost always along fall lines of rivers. And the reason why this is because fall lines are the places where the wide river valley meets the rocky shoals of a mountainous river. And so they're the place where boat travel meets foot travel. And whoever moderated that site, whoever mediated it rather, controlled it. And so Shawnees were quite savvy in locating themselves along fall lines because it meant that they could manage the trade between people moving up the Chesapeake Bay and people moving down it. And so it's a very savvy move on their part. But again, one of the terrifying characteristics of this movement and migration across the eastern half of North America is the violence associated with it. And so, as you can see, this beautiful item is, in fact, a terrifying thing. It's a slave halter. It might have been created by a Shawnee person. Some at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation believe that it was. And we see evidence of Shawnees and captive taking really all over the eastern half of North America. Some will move from the Ohio to South Carolina in order to take captives. Others are found in Maryland. But throughout, there's a real traffic in human beings rather. And the line between a captive and a slave is sometimes hard to discern. So that's something that we could talk about later. Some were adopted into the Shawnee tribe. Others were sold. And so that's something that we still need to learn more about. One of the things that the Shawnees did when they relocated to this region in Maryland and Pennsylvania, Opessa's town was another Shawnee town, by the way, is they mediated the traffic between the Catawba and the Iroquois. So if you can believe it, Iroquois people traveled all the way to the Catawbas in order to take captives. The Catawbas traveled all the way to New York in order to revenge themselves. And at some point, the Shawnees made themselves useful by essentially trying to stop the Catawbas from attacking the Iroquois. And to this day, the Catawbas tell stories about the Shawnees to their children. If they ever want them to keep quiet at night, they describe essentially Shawnees who are like wolves and might go out and get them if they aren't if they don't get quiet. And so the oral histories communicate something of the violence of this period, but also something of this massive traffic across this coastal world. So, if you're following these maps with me and thinking along with me, then I just would like you to notice something, which is that initially we have people moving from the Middle Ohio River Valley to the Atlantic coast. But that all changes between 1720 and 1754. After 1720, Shawnee people began returning to the Middle Ohio Valley and abandoning their close connection with coastal towns or fall line towns on the eastern half of the Appalachian Mountains. And so one of the people who I study in the book is this fellow named Peter Chartier, and this map indicates his movement. And as you can see, if we go back to the previous map here, his father, Martin Chartier, owned property in Conestoga Manor. So that would have been essentially here. But in 1718, at the time of Martin Chartier's death, his land, for which he had title, was taken by James Logan, who was William Penn's lawyer. And in response to that, Martin Chartier's son, rather, Peter, led a revitalization movement. And he traveled all this way trying to connect native people in resistance against the British and their nascent American colonies. And so one of the fascinating things about Peter Chartier is that this movement predates Tecumseh by quite a wide margin. So between 1720 and 1754, you have a tour of a Shawnee person throughout the northeastern United States, but also the southeastern United States. And that's one of the reasons why I love Shawnee history. It connects regions. It's not simply a southeastern phenomenon or a northeastern one. It's really about both worlds. And so all of these Shawnee people really challenge the paradigm of place that I mentioned previously. Movement became a reality, a fact of life, something that everyone had to accept. And so becoming adaptive, staying small, and migratory became essential characteristics of Shawnee survival. And so they're parochial cosmopolitans. And as this first image ever of a Shawnee person, this dates to 1796, as this image attests, Native people communicated who they were quite apart from other communities through their dress, through their ears, right? Cutting the auricle of an ear, right? Through their scalp lock, their hairstyle. All of these things would have communicated his Shawnee identity. And there we have a drop slide. Tecumseh's brother, Tenskwatawa, is supposed to be here. I apologize for that. And so what I'd like to do now is just change directions a little bit and move away from my second book and just say some global things about Shawnee people. And that is, whether we're talking about Peter Chartier or about Tecumseh or his brother Tenskwatawa, to me it's pretty obvious that Shawnees have always been at the forefront of Pan-Indianism and revitalization. And the reason I say that, and the reason why the Shawnees were, is because of their transience and their migrations. They truly had comprehended a continent, and they used this to connect Native peoples in the most important resistance movements of both the 18th and the 19th centuries. Excuse me. Oh, so there he is. There's Tenskwatawa. Apologies. So what's fascinating, though, is that most Shawnee people, while they're most famous people, people such as Tecumseh, while their most famous people were leaders of Pan-Indian revitalization, the vast majority of Shawnee people didn't follow them. And so this map indicates the areas where Shawnees were most predominant on the eve of the 19th century, immediately after the American Revolution. More than 1,500 Shawnee people lived in the Spanish land grant here, and their villages dot, of course, the eastern half of what is now Missouri below St. Louis. And so one of the questions that I deal with in my first book is why this was so. Why would Shawnee people refuse to follow their most famous leader? It's kind of confusing. And I think the reason why is because just as Fort Ancient people lived in small egalitarian villages, modern Shawnee people did too. Shawnee people preferred the village. They preferred their divisional identity over that of their larger Pan-Indian or tribal or national identity. After the 19th century, Shawnees were forced into what is now southwestern Missouri. And you can see Piankashaw, Peoria, Delaware, Kickapoo, and Shawnees all together. And here is where we meet one of the leaders of our grant, Kwadwipia, or Colonel Lewis. And like Tecumseh, like Peter Chartier, Kwadwipia toyed with ideas of new political identities, and he argued that an Indian state would render our living less precarious as well as less burdensome to our friends, the white people. So what's different here is that by the 19th century, people like Kwadwipia, who is really the first recognized chief of the Eastern Shawnee tribe, mentions friendship, and so he had an idea that there would actually be an Indian state that would send delegates to the United States House of Representatives, proportional to population. But as you know, this is how it ends for Kwadwipia. The United States rejects this idea of an Indian state and instead chooses to force people into tribal reservations. And so the Eastern Shawnee tribe winds up in the northeastern corner of the state. Here you can see the reservation that they initially shared with the Seneca. It's pretty clear that this kind of consolidation of people along tribal lines was designed to achieve assimilation. And I really see this grant as a chance to resist that. By returning Shawnee history to the Shawnee people themselves. And so I'd just like to end with a couple of points here. One is that the people who I have described have persisted in the face of ethnic cleansing and forced removal. They were forcibly removed from their homeland, which is Ohio, And yet today, their ceremonies, their identity as a people, both political and cultural, remains in place. And the reason why, I think, is because of stomp grounds. If you go to northeastern Oklahoma, you can visit, I think, upwards of 33 different stomp grounds, each of which represents a migratory historic village, each with its own unique history. And so, in the words of a friend, Chief Andy Warrior, identity isn't something that necessarily derives from place. The Shawnees learned that it's about action. Being Shawnee for Andy Warrior is a verb. And I think if you look at this quote, you'll see confirmation of that fact. So with that, I am out of time and I will stop talking.
All right. Thank you so much, Steve. I always so appreciate the way you use artworks in your presentation. And I love that you ended on this one. It's just such a lovely, and the one before it, such a great illustration of that quote and the idea of Shawnee being a verb. I'm going to go ahead and open up the chat box to questions. And at the same time, I'm going to pull up the last PowerPoint we had so that we have the date of the next webinar in front of us.
Sure.
And does anybody have any questions? All right, I don't see anyone typing. So I'll take that as no questions. And our next webinar coming up is June 17th. Looking forward to next year and what we have coming up and talking a little bit about the research that people have been working on over the year. So again, I want to thank Steve so much for joining us this afternoon, for taking time to put together the PowerPoint. I know he had to do some serious editing to fit into our little half-hour segment here, but it was really interesting, really wonderful. And if you haven't had a chance to check the new book out yet, please do, because it is, I've just started it, and so far it's wonderful. It's really good reading. All right, everyone, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you in June. I'll leave the chat box up for just a few minutes, just in case anyone has something, and we'll have the recording available for you guys by the end of the day tomorrow.